Hello and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, Resonance 104.4 FM's talk show about ideas. Little Atoms is based around ideas of the Enlightenment and actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism, and secular humanism. This means we often end up discussing the antithesis of these ideas, things like superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Tonight's show is presented by Padre Greedy and myself, Neil Denny, and our guest tonight is Raymond Tallis. Raymond Tallis was Professor of Geriatric Medicine at the University of Manchester until he left to become a full-time writer in 2006. He is the author of more than 250 medical publications. In addition to his medical work, Ray Tallis is author of many works of fiction and poetry and has written on the philosophy of the mind, philosophical anthropology, literary theory, the nature of art and cultural criticism. His books include The Kingdom of Infinite Space, Hippocratic Oaths, Medicine and Its Discontents, In Defense of Realism, The Knowing Animal, Hunger and Absence. In 2007, Ray was nominated in The Independent as one of 50 Brains of Britain, and this is Ray's second appearance on Little Atoms. Ray, it's a pleasure to have you back on Little Atoms again.
And it's a pleasure to be back on, thank you.
I just wanted to briefly talk about your most recent book, The Kingdom of Infinite Space, which is a study of the head, but it makes it very plain that it's going to be a study of a head that doesn't, that tries to avoid as much as possible talking about the brain, which might seem an interesting concept. Tell us why that is.
Yes, it may seem a little perverse, you know, it's a bit like having Hamlet, in which Hamlet only has a walk-on part. The brain is there more, perhaps, than appears at first sight. But in a sense, this is a bit of corrective action. We've had too many headless brains, and if you look at any newspaper, you'll see brain scans and so on and so forth, and they're somewhat disembodied, never mind disenvironed. And this is, to some extent, a corrective action. It's also because I believe, against many people, that the brain isn't a sufficient explanation of our consciousness. We need to be fully conscious in the way we are, indeed to be conscious at all. The brain needs a body, and that body needs to be environed, and part of that environment is the community of minds, which has been built up over hundreds of thousands of years, which you can't find inside the brain.
Before we move on and talk about that, because we're going to talk about that subject in a bit more detail soon, let's talk a little bit more about the head then. So tell us some more about the head that doesn't involve the brain.
Well, I mean, when I started this book, I realised I'd basically entered an ocean, because there is an infinite number of things you could say about the head.
Hence the title.
Hence the title, absolutely. I mean, the first thing to be said about it is it gets on with lots of things that we ourselves don't seem to have to do, and that's rather undermines one's sense of being an independent agent. If you identify with your head, the notion that your head also has got business of its own to transact is quite disturbing. And so at the beginning I spend quite a lot of time talking about the kind of secretions the head produces. However, we humans, being what we are, actually regain the initiative, because pretty well every single one of those secretions, which are biological in origin, we've subordinated to cultural aims. And I talk about the cultural significance of spitting, what we get up to with earwax, and the significance of tears and so on.
I'm amused by what we get up to with earwax. I hadn't been aware of what we got up to.
Well, earwax, yes. I mean, we don't get up too much with earwax, but, for example, it's been used to track the migrations of the Inuit people, because there are different genetically determined types of earwax that correspond to different tribes of people. So you can work out where Inuit people went without even seeing their footsteps in the snow by just looking at the earwax in their descendants. So that's the kind of thing we do, even with something as simple as earwax.
Yeah. There was a really interesting image that had never occurred to me before, right, quite near the beginning of the book. And it goes for the whole body as well, but, I mean, you're talking about it in terms of the head. But it's our head, you know, we own, as we perceive, our bodies. It's our bodies, it's us, you know, it's ourselves. But there are parts of our head that we can't experience, we can't touch. Like, for instance, the inside of our brain cavity, for instance. Yes. So, well, tell us a little bit more about that.
It seemed to me that one of the reasons I wrote the book was to look at the very different relationships we have to our bodies. I mean, we are to some extent identical with our bodies, but not entirely identical. We certainly suffer our bodies as if they were alien items. We know our bodies factually. We utilise our bodies as tools, and so on and so forth. So we have quite a lot of different kinds of relationships to our bodies. I mean, one of the most puzzling is the relationship of possession. You know, in what sense do I own my head, and in what sense am I it? So that was another reason for writing the book, was to use the head as a way of exploring the different relations we have to our bodies, and the mystery of embodiment, the mystery of being an embodied subject, as opposed to either an organism, or a ghost, or a pure mind.
So we just spoke about the idea that this is a book that doesn't feature as much as perhaps it should the brain. And you've just written a piece for the last issue of New Humanities magazine, which was called Neurotrash, which basically takes exception to the idea that neuroscience is being used in ways that go above and beyond basically the study of the brain and the study of the mind. So tell us more what you mean by that.
Well, the fundamental intuition I have is that the brain is a necessary condition for all aspects of human consciousness. You know, if you chop my head off, my IQ would fall quite significantly. But it isn't a sufficient condition. And that the fact you can see correlations between brain activity and certain kinds of experiences and certain kinds of behaviour doesn't mean to say those experiences and those behaviour are identical with or entirely explained by brain activity. So it's part of a long campaign, really, to say, hang on, neuroscience is extremely useful within its limits. And nearly all my own research has been in clinical neuroscience, and I have been thrilled by the new methods of neuroimaging which have shown how the brain recovers after damage. But I've been less thrilled by the way then people feel that because they believe that the brain explains every aspect of us, we can really almost replace the humanities by branches of neuroscience. And you'll have seen dozens and dozens of new disciplines, neuro-hyphenated disciplines like neuroeconomics and neuroethics, neurotheology, neuroesthetics, a particular bugbear of mine because art is one of the things that matters to me more than anything else. And so that article is part of my campaign against the inappropriate use of neuroscience, its extrapolation into areas where it really can cast no light on our nature.
So you say particularly neuroesthetics is something you have a real problem with. Would you like to elucidate on that a little?
I have a problem because art means to me pretty well as much as anything. You know, Nietzsche once said, you know, without music life would be a mistake, and I would entirely agree with him. And if you add in literature and you add in visual arts, then that's absolutely true. But there have been developments within the humanities, particularly within literary criticism and art criticism, that try to explain the impact of literature or the impact of works of art in terms of the particular capacity to stimulate parts of the nervous system. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the most ludicrous examples, which has caused me a lot of trouble because I upset an awful lot of people in the article I wrote in the Times Literary Supplement, was the suggestion that we can understand John Donne's poetry because it has a specific effect on particular pathways in the nervous system. Certain syntactic inversions, for example, trigger off impulses in particular parts of the nervous system. And I concluded from observing or examining what people have claimed people made, particularly A.S. Byatt, who is particularly prominent in this field, that it's bad neuroscience, it's wrong about literature, and wrong about humanity. Otherwise, it's okay, I suppose.
But would the implication, for me, the implication there would be that if it is a simple physical impulse, that it would be a physical impulse that is replicated almost universally, so
exactly.
Everyone would enjoy John
exactly.
Donne automatically.
I mean, that is absolutely the point. It seems to me that if John Donne stimulated your nervous system just in the way that very other simple stimuli do, you would have no choice. Everybody would enjoy John Donne. They would enjoy it the same way every time they read it. So a second reading would have the same impact as a first reading. And also, we wouldn't really need to take account of any of the historical background, any of the very complex cultural ironies that are woven into his poetry. We would just sit there and get ourselves tickled up by syntactic inversions and other particular tropes. I mean, it's the grotesque simplification of the impact of works of art and the failure to recognise that they impact differently on different people, which is your point.
Yeah.
There's also in this article a mention of the idea of art, or the visual arts, and art criticism as being somehow, well, particularly with the visual arts, almost as if there's, to parallel it with sort of evolution, like the development, the evolution of the styles of art over the centuries have inevitably had something to do with neuroscience as well, and those things have almost been, you know, they've been inevitable, those leaps. I mean, this is This is the argument they're making, isn't it? Do I understand that right?
It may be one of the arguments they've made. It seems to me that it's actually contradicted by the history of art.
I mean,
a lot of people such as Semyazeki, who have focused on visual arts, have tended to concentrate on people like Mondrian and Malevich and so on, whose works do appear to address particular parts of the visual pathway. But actually, even that doesn't begin to explain the impact of Mondrian. Mondrian began as a scandal, first of all. You know, what is this? Is this a painting or what? Secondly, it doesn't take account of the narrative and cultural aspects of art. You know, if you look at Rembrandt's series of self-portraits, they're an incredibly poignant account of the course of a human life. And that clearly is not going to be captured by stimulating a particular part of the visual pathways. So, basically, they are desperately ahistorical, and they're not even able to account for the impact of their favoured artists, those who appear to address, as it were, the optic pathways more narrowly.
So what do you think is the drive behind this, you know, well, apparently what seems to me a very unattractive idea? Why go for this idea that we are simply responding to stimuli in an automatic way?
I can see why it might be attractive to neuroscientists, because when you have a subject, you want to say your subject is the last word and absolutely everything.
Yes.
So imperialism is always, you know, a natural human tendency, if I can speak of nature in relation to human beings. The question really is, why has it been attractive to, for example, literary critics?
Exactly.
And I think in many ways it's a reaction against social constructivism. If you think for 20 or 30 years, literary criticism was dominated by something called theory. I mean, if you think of theory, it basically said that when we're looking at, say, works of literature, we're looking at texts, and their meaning essentially is entirely related to the system of signs to which those texts belong. They don't refer to a natural world out there or indeed an objective world out there. It's all about systems of signification, and deconstruction theory was all about teasing the conflicting significations within a particular text. Well, this kind of social constructivism and linguistic idealism, A, delivered nothing, and B, eventually became boring when everybody who was propagating it got tenure and there was no more need to produce more papers. And so there was a complete and total reaction away from social constructivism to biologism. People thought, gosh, you know, there really is a living reader out there, and that living reader is a living organism, and these clever chaps with brain science will tell us, you know, what reading is about and what the reaction to literature is about. It's all about brain science. And actually, there's an amazing passage from Norman Bryson, who originally was a social constructivist, describing his moment of conversion, to realise reading was all about the nervous system. And I suspect in that sense, it was a reaction against their own lunacy to the opposite lunacy. But of course, when you have a new interdisciplinary development, then of course you've got all sorts of benefits. New publications, new conferences, new grant applications. You know, as John Bailey once said, you know, interdisciplinary studies is the art of rising between two stools.
A few months ago, we had on the show the very eminent neuroscientist and writer David Eagleman. He heads up a department at the University of Texas in Houston, I think it is, that's basically studying the concept of neurolaw and the idea of applying. The number of it, I suppose, is that, you know, neurological conditions should be taken into consideration in the application of sentencing, for instance. I wonder what you think of this idea, and whether this is similar to what you're describing, or whether this is a more sensible thing, or perhaps even a dangerous idea.
Well, the notion, if you put the brain on the stand and the brain takes the rap and my brain may maybe do it, has always been there. If you think right back to the McNaughton ruling in 1945, it was recognised poor old McNaughton really was not responsible for what he was doing. He, you know, his brain certainly did make him do it. The trouble with neurolaw is it doesn't give us any guidance as to when we should stop assuming somebody's responsible for their actions. Just because they've got an imbalance between the frontal lobes and the amygdaloid body, that doesn't say, well, actually, therefore that person wasn't responsible. If you believe none of us, if you believe our brains explain everything about what we do, then it explains the good things we do, like, you know, offering somebody a cup of tea at a tea party. You know, presumably my brain maybe do that, or my brain maybe become a lawyer defending my client. And worse than that, if you see the brain as a material object, which it is, then the brain itself is actually wired into a much greater causal net. And in the end, my brain made me do it becomes the Big Bang made me do it, because there is, you know, no point at which the causal chain breaks off. So I think the use of neuroimaging really doesn't add anything, unfortunately, to the kind of common sense intuitions one has to mobilise when one's acknowledging that somebody may have diminished or indeed no responsibility for an action for which they would otherwise be prosecuted.
It seems that everything we're talking about in terms of neuroscience in these examples, and you've already raised this point, they're all talking about the brain causing you to do something as almost as an automaton without recourse to all the other cultural influences that surround us. And I want to bring in again the idea of evolution and Darwin into this, because you've coined the term Darwinitis to describe this, what seems to be quite common now, which is the idea of ascribing Darwin to social interactions and our social behaviour over and above how it affects our biological makeup. So when do you think this started to happen?
I think it began with sociobiology in the 1970s with E.O. Wilson, but it has developed very rapidly since then. I mean, the central notion of evolutionary psychology, which is the biggest branch of Darwinitis, the inflamed state of Darwinism, as you were, the essential notion is that all of our behaviour can be explained as directly or indirectly being designed to optimise the chances of our genes replicating. And although we think we do things for certain reasons, actually what's going on is something quite different, namely that we are propelled by our genetic predisposition to act in certain ways to ensure that our genome has a better than evens chance of replicating. It seems to me it doesn't take any account of the complexity of human life. And if we go back to the notion of neurolaw, if the notion of my brain made me do it, and you mentioned the role of culture, you can see plausibly your brain may seem to make you do it if, in a pub, after 16 pints of beer, the red mist descends and you punch somebody. There you've probably got diminished responsibility. But in this case, you're responsible for your diminished responsibility. You set out to the pub that night, you drank 16 pints of beer. And in many ways, we will always have difficulty in finding free will if we think of our behaviour as being as a set of events which have immediate prior causes. But if I think about this interview we're having, the cause of this interview actually isn't a causal chain that, you know, or what I'm saying isn't a causal chain that began, you know, a few minutes ago. You know, we had a meeting at the Battle of Ideas, and we both thought, you know, all three of us thought it was a good idea to meet. And that's a much more complicated thing. I mean, you were mobilising all sorts of causal chains in order to get here from Leicester, to arrange that we meet, and so on and so forth. But the fact remains there isn't a single linear cause between the moment when we chose that we should have this interview and now when we're having the interview. It reaches deep into a personal space that each of us have, into a soil of the self. So it seems to me that those who look for our freedom and our deliberate actions and our conscious agency often look in the wrong place, and therefore they don't find it. They think of us as basically a chain of causes and effects, and that's wrong. We actually have terrific temporal depth. And by the way, there's no temporal depth in the material world. The material world doesn't have explicit time. The material world exists only in the present tense.
Yeah. But on the material world, is there somewhere in all this, in the kind of fetishization of neuroscience, on, is there an attempt, perhaps misguided, to in some ways recreate lab conditions on all aspects of life? So behaviour can be explained by this, you know, experiment that we do, and we see these things happen when we do this. And the people talk sometimes about the elevation of science as a religion, but it seems maybe it's the elevation of the misunderstanding of scientific processes to a religion.
I mean, taking your last point first, essentially, science is magnificent. Scientism, which basically elevates it to an explain-all and even a religion, is quite the reverse. And I like your observation about trying to, as it were, encompass the whole of our life in sort of in lab conditions. I mean, if you think of the experiments done on love by Semir Zeki, you know, he said, what is romantic love? Well, what we do is we expose a series of subjects who are currently in love with somebody to a picture of the person they're in love with, and we also show them pictures of people they aren't in love with. And the difference between the brain activity in those two conditions is what love consists of. It's activity in the anterior cingulate gyrus and one or two other places. Well, that is exactly the kind of lab reductionism which I guess you were probably sort of hinting at, which is just nonsense. I mean, most of our actions in everyday life are incredibly complex. Being in love, for example, is not being in love at the moment, or, you know, being cross with somebody, or being, you know, organising your life so you can see them. All sorts of complicated things. And neuroeconomists now want to say that the reason we buy mortgages, we had subprime mortgages, or an outbreak of them, was the balance between the frontal lobes, which really inhibit our behaviour, and the amygdaloid body, which wants to go right in there and spend, spend, spend. You think, well, hang on a moment, in order to get a mortgage, even at the height of the subprime epidemic, you really had to work very hard and make many visits to the mortgage agency. You had to lie on your self-decoration and so on and so forth. So you can't see that as a series of responses to a series of stimuli. No. So, but you couldn't possibly capture that in a lab. You know, if you're going to buy a subprime mortgage, you set out and think, damn it, I've just remembered, I meant to go and get that form, so you have to go back again. Well, all that complicated behaviour in everyday life has to be infused by an explicit sense of goal and purpose, mm-hmm. which isn't there in the lab.
And, of course, also someone has to sell you the subprime mortgage, so they have to have
So the whole legal framework and the cultural context, you know, my mummy told me it was bad to run up debts you can't pay back, and now there's no regard less bad. So there are whole cultural changes and, indeed, a legal framework or lack thereof that makes it possible. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Before we finish, I'd like to briefly talk about your next book, which is coming out early in the new year, and it's called Michelangelo's Finger. And the subtitle is An Exploration of Everyday Transcendence, which is something that might immediately provoke an image of religion or something. Yes. So tell us what you mean by that.
For me, transcendence begins at the level of ordinary perception. I mean, people are often fascinated by ESP, extrasensory perception. As far as I'm concerned, sensory perception is utterly magical, utterly unexplained. And by the way, it's not explained neurologically either. Neuroscience can explain how the light gets in and stimulates nerve impulses. It can't explain how the gaze looks out. So, for example, I'm aware of you as quite other than me. And yet I have an experience that actually transcends itself. It actually infers from itself the existence of an object, or indeed, in your case, of a mind, that goes beyond me. That's what I mean by transcendence. That's the ground floor of transcendence. Michelangelo's finger is about the very simple act of pointing, using, and the finger in question, of course, is the index finger. And amongst the other things that the book develops is the notion of the role of pointing and similar gestures in the transition from pre-verbal or pre-linguistic to linguistic states. Children, for example, learning to speak, if you see them in their prams, about 10 months, they're pointing at everything. And the marvellous thing about pointing is that it's, first of all, it invites someone to share attention, joint visual attention. And so it says, basically, I'm aware that I have seen something that you haven't. So I have an awareness of your mind. But secondly, if you're pointing to something that I can't see, I have an intuition of something that exists, but I'm not experiencing it. So that takes further the idea of objects that transcend my actual experience. And in a way, pointing is the beginning of the sense of the hidden. The ultimate expression of our sense of the hidden, of course, is religious belief. The idea that the whole of the universe really is supported by something hidden. Hidden realm and hidden entity called God.
Do you think the idea of transcendence is available to us without recourse to religion?
That's a really good question. I think it needs to be recovered from religion, because I believe religion actually grew out of everyday transcendence. And the sense of the hidden, or the sense of the divine hidden, came from our sense of the ordinary hidden. The sense of a coherent world came from, initially, our feeling of a coherent visual field. I mean, my position is that I do not believe in any supernatural explanation of what we are. I don't think we fell from the sky quite by a separate process. I think, as organisms, we came into being by the same processes that centipedes and rabbits came into being. But nor do I believe that we're entirely part of nature. So I'm against supernaturalism and I'm against naturalism. And it seems to me that reminding ourselves of how different we are from other living creatures is a very important job for a philosopher. And it must be the basis of a humanism. A humanism that isn't at risk of collapsing back into a pessimistic naturalism.
That's sort of an exceptionalism that is almost in danger of suggesting that we're somehow special in comparison to the rest of nature, and that's an idea that's sort of looked upon with suspicion nowadays.
First of all, I think we are special. Secondly, I think we've got to think how we became special, and I think one of the challenges for humanism is to say, how did we become to be so different? It's a talk I'm giving tonight at the Humanist Society. You know, how did we get to be so special? And I think we can invoke all sorts of biological differences that ultimately enabled us to escape from biology. Is it dangerous? I think the opposite is dangerous. If you look at someone like John Gray and Straw Dogs, you know, he says we are not special. In fact, you know, we're not much above slime mold, and we are Homo rapiens, you know, we're absolutely ghastly, we've, you know, destroyed the planet, and so on and so forth. Well, I think that kind of utter pessimism about humanity, first of all, is insincere. He doesn't think the holder of the chair of European thought in LSE, John Gray, is an animal or not more worthy than the slime mold. I'm sure he doesn't apply it to himself. And secondly, when you start thinking about other fellow people as pretty well the same as slime mold, you're more likely to apply that to strangers than you are to apply it to your own kith and kin, and we know where that leads. Mm-hmm. So I think valuing humans for their specialness is very important. It stops us going down the abyss, which we've explored pretty thoroughly in the 20th century. But also we have to recognise that, you know, because we're special, we have special responsibilities. You know, we have stewardship of this planet that certainly no rabbit has.
That's a good point to end on, and to take us into the weekend. Ray, thank you very much for speaking to us again.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a talk show about ideas, with Padre Greedy and me, Neil Denny. You can download our previous shows and find details of upcoming guests from our website, www.littleatoms.com, and the Little Atoms podcast is also available on iTunes. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.